I was finally able to get into the zone, but couldn't do anything once I got there. I keep a steno pad handy for notes, character lists, page references, date chronologies, and I doodled in there a little bit, but the sheet of paper in the IBM remained blank. There was no thundering heartbeat, no throbbing eyes or difficulty breathing, no panic attack, in other words. But there was no story, either. Andy Drake, John Shackelford, Ray Garrity, the beautiful Regina Whiting, they stood with their backs turned, refusing to speak or move. The manuscript was sitting in its accustomed place on the left side of the typewriter, the pages held down with a pretty chunk of quartz I'd found on the lane. But nothing was happening. Zilch. I recognized an irony here, perhaps even a moral. For years, I had fled the problems of the real world, escaping into various Narnias of my imagination. Now the real world had filled up with bewildering thickets. There were things with teeth in some of them, and the wardrobe was locked against me. Kyra, I had printed, putting her name inside a scalloped shape that was supposed to be a cabbage rose. Below it, I had drawn a piece of bread with a beret tipped rakishly on the top crust. Noonan's conception of French toast. The letters LB surrounded with curlicues. A shirt with a rudimentary duck on it. Beside this, I had printed quack, quack. Below quack, quack, I had written ought to fly away, bon voyage. At another spot on the sheet, I had written Dean, Auster, and DeVore. They were the ones who had seemed the most there, the most dangerous. Because they had descendants? But surely all seven of those Jacks mustn't they? In those days, most families were whoppers. And where had I been? I had asked, but DeVore hadn't wanted to say. It didn't feel any more like a dream at 9:30 on a sullenly hot Sunday morning. Which left exactly what? Visions? Time travel? And if there was a purpose to such travel, what was it? What was the message, and who was trying to send it? I remembered clearly what I'd said just before passing from the dream in which I had sleepwalked out to Joe's studio and brought back my typewriter. I don't believe these lies, nor would I now, until I could see at least some of the truth. It might be safer to believe nothing at all. At the top of the sheet upon which I was doodling, in heavily stroked letters, I printed the word DANGER, then circled it. From the circle, I drew an arrow to Kyra's name. From her name, I drew an arrow to ought to go away, bon voyage, and added Maddie. Below the bread wearing the beret, I drew a little telephone. Above it, I put a cartoon balloon with r-r-ring in it. As I finished this, the cordless phone rang. It was sitting on the deck rail. I circled Maddie and picked up the phone. Mike? She sounded excited, happy, relieved. Yeah, I said. How are you? Great, she said, and I circled LB on my pad. Lindy Briggs called 10 minutes ago. I just got off the phone with her. Mike, she's giving me my job back. Isn't that wonderful? Sure. And wonderful how it would keep her in town. I crossed out, ought to go away, bon voyage, knowing that Maddie wouldn't go. Not now. And how could I ask her to? I thought again, if only I knew a little more. Mike, are you... It's very wonderful, I said. In my mind's eye, I could see her standing in the kitchen, drawing the kinked telephone cord through her fingers, her legs long and coltish below her denim shorts. I could see the shirt she was wearing, a white tee with a yellow duck paddling across the front. I hope Lindy had the good grace to sound ashamed of herself. I circled the T-shirt I'd drawn. She did, and she was frank enough to kind of, well, disarm me. She said the Whitmore woman talked to her early last week. It was very frank and to the point, Lindy said. I was to be let go immediately. If that happened, the money... computer equipment and software DeVore funneled into the library would keep coming. If it didn't, the flow of goods and money would stop immediately. She said she had to balance the good of the community against what she knew was wrong. She said it was one of the toughest decisions she ever had to make. Uh-huh. On the pad, my hand moved of its own volition, like a planchette gliding over a Ouija board. printing the words, "Please, can't I please?" There's probably some truth in it. But, Maddie, how much do you suppose Lindy makes?
I don't know.
I bet it's more than any three other small-town librarians in the state of Maine combined. In the background, I heard Kai.
Can I talk, Maddie? Can I talk to Mike? Please, can't I please?
In a minute, hon. Then, to me, maybe. All I know is that I have my job back, and I'm willing to let bygones be bygones. On the page, I drew a book. Then I drew a series of interlocked circles between it and the duck T-shirt. Kai wants to talk to you, Maddie said, laughing. She says the two of you went to the Freiburg Fair last night.
Whoa, you mean I had a date with a pretty girl and slept through it?
Seems that way. Are you ready for her?
Ready.
Okay, here comes the chatterbox. There was a rustling as the phone changed hands, then Kai was there.
I tackled you at the fair, Mike. I tackled my own quartermack.
Did you? I asked. That was quite a dream, wasn't it, Kai? There was a long silence at the other end. I could imagine Maddie wondering what had happened to her telephone chatterbox. At last, Kai said in a hesitating voice,
You there, too.
Too.
We saw the snake dance ladies, the pole with the bell on top. We went in the spooky house.
You fell down in the barrel.
It wasn't a dream, was it? I could have convinced her that it was, but all at once that seemed like a bad idea, one that was dangerous in its own way. I said, You had on a pretty hat and a pretty dress.
Yeah.
Kai sounded enormously relieved. And you had on... Kyra, stop. Listen to me. She stopped at once. It's better if you don't talk about that dream too much, I think. To your mom or to anyone except me. Except you. Yes. And the same with the refrigerator people, okay?
Okay.
Mike, there was a lady in Maddie's clothes.
I know, I said.
It was all right for her to talk. I was sure of it, but I asked anyway. Where's Maddie now?
Watering the flowers. We got lots of flowers, a billion at least. I have to clean up the table. It's a chore.
I don't mind, though. I like chores. We had French toast. We always do on Sundays. It's yummy, especially with strawberry syrup.
I know, I said, drawing an arrow to the piece of bread wearing the beret. French toast is great.
Kai, did you tell your mom about the lady in her dress?
No, I thought it might scare her.
She dropped her voice.
Here she comes.
That's all right, but we've got a secret, right?
Yes.
Now can I talk to Maddie again?
Okay.
Her voice moved off a little. Mommy, Bommy, Mike wants to talk to you. Then she came back. Will you visit us today? We could go on another picnic.
I can't today, Kai. I have to work.
Maddie never works on Sunday.
Well, when I'm writing a book, I write every day. I have to, or else I'll forget the story. Maybe we'll have a picnic on Tuesday, though. A barbecue picnic at your house.
Is it long till Tuesday?
Not too long. Day after tomorrow.
Is it long to write a book?
Medium long.
I could hear Maddie telling Kai to give her the phone.
I will. Just one more second. Mike?
I'm here, Kai.
I love you.
I was both touched and terrified. For a moment, I was sure my throat was going to lock up the way my chest used to when I tried to write. Then it cleared, and I said, Love you too, Kai.
Here's Maddie.
Again, there was the rustly sound of the telephone changing hands. Then Maddie said, Did that refresh your recollection of your date with my daughter, sir?
Well, I said, it certainly refreshed hers.
There was a link between Maddie and I, but it didn't extend to this. I was sure of it. She was laughing. I loved the way she sounded this morning, and I didn't want to bring her down. But I didn't want her mistaking the white line in the middle of the road for the cross mark, either. Maddie, you still need to be careful, okay? Just because Lindy Briggs offered you your old job back doesn't mean everyone in town is suddenly your friend.
I understand that, she said.
I thought again about asking if she'd consider taking Kai up to Derry for a while. They can live in my house, stay for the duration of the summer, if that was what it took for things to return to normal down here. Except she wouldn't do it.
When it came to accepting my offer of high-priced New York legal talent, she'd had no choice. About this, she did, or thought she did, and how could I change her mind? I had no logic, no connected facts. All I had was a vague, dark shape, like something lying beneath 9 inches of snow-blind ice. "I want you to be careful of two men in particular," I said. "One is Bill Dean. The other is Kenny Oster. He's the one with the big dog who wears the neckerchief. He..."
"That's Booberry," Kai called from the middle distance. "Booberry licked my facey."
"Go out and play, hon," Maddie said.
"I'm clearing the table."
"You can finish later. Go on outside now."
There was a pause as she watched Kai go out the door, taking Strickland with her. Although the kid had left the trailer, Maddie still spoke in the lowered tone of someone who doesn't want to be overheard.
"Are you trying to scare me?"
"No," I said, drawing repeated circles around the word danger. "But I want you to be careful. Bill and Kenny may have been on DeVore's team, like Footman and Osgood. Don't ask me why I think that might be, because I have no satisfactory answer. It's only a feeling, but since I got back on the TR, my feelings are different."
"What do you mean?"
"Are you wearing a T-shirt with a duck on it?"
"How do you know that? Did Kai tell you?"
"Did she take the little stuffed dog from her Happy Meal out with her just now?"
A long pause. At last, Maddie said, "My God," in a voice so low I could hardly hear it. Then again,
"How?"
"I don't know how. I don't know if you're still in a bad situation either, or why you might be, but I feel that you are, that you both are." I could have said more, but I was afraid she'd think I'd gone entirely off the rails.
"He's dead," she burst out. "That old man is dead. Why can't he leave us alone?"
"Maybe he has. Maybe I'm wrong about all this, but there's no harm in being careful, is there?"
"No," she said. "Usually that's true."
"Usually?"
"Why don't you come and see me, Mike? Maybe we could go to the fair together."
"Maybe this fall we will. All three of us.
I'd like that.
In the meantime, I'm thinking about the key."
"Thinking is half your problem, Mike," she said and laughed again. Ruefully, I thought. And I saw what she meant.
What she didn't seem to understand was that feeling was the other half. It's a sling, and in the end, I think it rocks most of us to death.
I carried the IBM back into the house and left the manuscript on top. I was done with it, at least for the time being. No more looking for the way back through the wardrobe. No more Andy Drake and John Shackelford until this was over. And as I dressed in long pants and a button-up shirt for the first time in what felt like weeks, it occurred to me that perhaps something, some force, had been trying to sedate me with the story I was telling, with the ability to work again. It made sense. Work had always been my drug of choice, even better than the booze or the Melorel I still kept in the bathroom medicine cabinet. Or maybe the work was only the delivery system, the hypo with all the dreamy dreams inside it. Maybe the real drug was the zone, being in the zone, feeling it, you sometimes hear the basketball players say. I was in the zone, and I was really feeling it. I grabbed the keys to the Chevrolet off the counter and looked at the fridge as I did. The magnets were circled again. In the middle was a message I'd seen before, one that was now instantly understandable, thanks to the extra Magnabet letters. "Help her."
"I'm doing my best," I said, and went out.
Three miles north on Route 68, by then you're on the part of it which used to be known as Castle Rock Road, there's a greenhouse with a shop in front of it. Slips and Greens, it's called, and Joe used to spend a fair amount of time there, buying gardening supplies or just noodling with the two women who ran the place. One of them was Helen Oster, Kenny's wife. I pulled in there at around 10 o'clock that Sunday morning. It was open, of course. During tourist season, almost every main shopkeeper turns heathen, and parked next to a Beamer with New York plates. I paused long enough to hear the weather forecast on the radio, continued hot and humid for another 48 hours at least, and then got out. A woman wearing a bathing suit, a skirt, and a giant red sun hat emerged from the shop with a bag of peat moss cradled in her arms. She gave me a little smile. I returned it with 18% interest. She was from New York, and that meant she wasn't a Martian. The shop was even hotter and damper than the white morning outside. Lila Prue, the co-owner, was on the phone. There was a little fan beside the cash register, and she was standing directly in front of it, flapping the front of her sleeveless blouse. She saw me and twiddled her fingers in a wave. I twiddled mine back, feeling like someone else. Work or no work, I was still zoning, still feeling it. I walked around the shop, picking up a few things almost at random, watching Lila out of the corner of my eye and waiting for her to get off the phone so I could talk to her. And all the time, my own private hyperdrive was humming softly away. At last she hung up, and I came to the counter. "Michael Noonan, what a sight for sore eyes you are," she said, and began ringing up my purchases. "I was awfully sorry to hear about Joanna. Got to get that right up front. Joe was a pet." "Thanks, Lila." "Welcome. Don't need to say any more about it, but with a thing like that, it's best to put it right up front. I've always believed it, always will believe it, right up front. Going to do a little gardening, are you?"
"If it ever cools off."
"Aya, isn't it wicked?" She flapped the top of her blouse again to show me how wicked it was, then pointed at one of my purchases. "Want this one in a special bag? Always safe, never sorry, that's my motto."
I nodded, then looked at the little blackboard tilted against the counter.
"Fresh blueberries," the chalked message read. "The crop is in."
"I'll have a pint of berries, too," I said, "as long as they're not Fridays. I can do better than Friday." She nodded vigorously, as if to say she knew damned well I could.
"These were on the bush yesterday. That fresh enough for you?"
"Good as gold," I said.
"Blueberry's the name of Kenny's dog, isn't it?"
"Ain't he a funny one? God, I love a big dog if he's behaved."
She turned, got a pint of berries from her little fridge, and put them in another bag for me.
"Where's Helen?" I asked. "Day off?"
"Not her," Lila said. "If she's in town, you can't get her out of this place unless you beat her with a stick. She and Kenny and the kids went down to Taxachusetts. Them and her brother's family club together and get a seaside cottage 2 weeks every summer. They all went. Old Blueberry, he'll chase seagulls until he drops."
She laughed. It was a loud and hearty one. It made me think of Sarah Tidwell. Or maybe it was the way Lila looked at me as she did it. There was no laughter in her eyes. They were small and considering, coldly curious. "Would you, for Christ's sake, quit it?" I told myself. "They can't all be in on it together, Mike."
"Couldn't they, though? There is such a thing as town consciousness. Anyone who doubts it has never been to a New England town meeting. Where there's a consciousness, is there not likely to be a subconscious?
And if Kyra and I were doing the old mind-meld thing, could not other people in TR-90 also be doing it, perhaps without even knowing it? We all shared the same air and land. We shared the lake and the aquifer which lay below everything, buried water tasting of rock and minerals. We shared the street as well, that place where good pups and vile dogs could walk side by side. As I started out with my purchases in a cloth carry-handle bag, Lila said,
"What a shame about Royce Merrill. Did you hear?"
"No," I said.
"Fell down his cellar stairs yesterday evening. What a man his age was doing going down such a steep flight of steps is beyond me, but I suppose once you get to his age, you have your own reasons for doing things."
"Is he dead?" I started to ask, then rephrased. It wasn't the way the question was expressed on the TR. "Did he pass?"
"Not yet. Martin Rescue took him to Castle County General. He's in a coma. They don't think he'll ever wake up, poor fella. There's a piece of history that'll die with him."
"I suppose that's true. Good riddance," I thought.
"Does he have children?"
"No. There have been Merrills on the TR for 200 years. One died at Seminary Ridge. But all the old families are dying out now. You have a nice day, Mike."
She smiled. Her eyes remained flat and considering. I got into my Chevy, put the bag with my purchases in it on the passenger seat, then simply sat for a moment, letting the air conditioner pour cool air on my face and neck. Kenny Oster was in Taxachusetts. That was good, a step in the right direction. But there was still my caretaker.
"Bill's not here," Yvette said.
She stood in the door, blocking it as well as she could. You can only do so much in that regard when you're 5'3 and weigh roughly 100 pounds. Studying me with the gimlet gaze of a nightclub bouncer, denying re-entry to a drunk who's already been tossed out on his ear once. I was on the porch of the neat-as-ever-you-saw Cape Cod, which stands at the top of Peabody Hill and looks all the way across New Hampshire and into Vermont's backyard. Bill's equipment sheds were lined up to the left of the house, all of them painted the same shade of gray, each with its own sign. Dean caretaking number 1, number 2, and number 3. Parked in front of number 2 was Bill's Dodge Ram. I looked at it, then back at Yvette. Her lips tightened a little more. Another notch, and I figured they'd be gone entirely.
"He went to North Conway with Butch Wiggins," she said. "They went in Butch's truck to get..."
"No need lying for me, dear heart," Bill said from behind her. It was still 2 hours shy of noon, and on the Lord's Day to boot, but I had never heard a man who sounded more tired. He clumped down the hall, and as he came out of its shadows and into the light, the sun was finally burning through the murk. I saw that Bill now looked his age, every year of it, and maybe 10 more to grow on. He was wearing his usual khaki shirt and pants. Bill Dean would be a Dickies man until the day he died. But his shoulders looked slumped, almost sprained, as if he'd spent a week lugging buckets that were too heavy for him. The falling away of his face had finally begun, an indefinable something that makes the eyes look too big, the jaw too prominent, the mouth a bit loose. He looked old. There were no children to carry on the family line of work, either. All the old families were dying out, Lila Prue had said, and maybe that was a good thing.
"Bill,"
she began, but he raised one of his big hands to stop her. The calloused fingertips shook a little.
"Go in the kitchen a dite," he told her. "I need to talk to my compadre here. 'Twon't take long."
Yvette looked at him, and when she looked back at me, she had indeed reached zero lip surface. There was just a black line where they had been, like a mark dashed off with a pencil. I saw with woeful clarity that she hated me.
"Don't you tire him out," she said to me. "He hasn't been sleeping. It's the heat."
She walked back down the hall, all stiff back and high shoulders, disappearing into shadows that were probably cool. It always seems to be cool in the houses of old people. Have you noticed? Bill came out onto the porch and put his big hands into the pockets of his pants without offering to shake with me.
"I ain't got nothing to say to you. You and me's quits."
"Why, Bill? Why are we quits?" He looked west where the hills stepped into the burning summer haze, disappearing into it before they could become mountains, and said nothing. "I'm trying to help that young woman." He gave me a look from the corners of his eyes that I could read well enough.
"Yeah, help yourself right into her pants. I see men come up from New York and New Jersey with their young girls. Summer weekends, ski weekends, it don't matter. Men who go with girls that age always look the same. Got their tongues run out even when their mouths are shut. Now you look the same."
I felt both angry and embarrassed, but I resisted the urge to chase him in that direction. That was what he wanted. "What happened here?" I asked him. "What did your fathers and grandfathers and great-grandfathers do to Sarah Tidwell and her family? You didn't just move them on, did you?"
"Didn't have to," Bill said, looking past me at the hills.
His eyes were moist almost to the point of tears, but his jaw was set and hard.
"They moved on themselves. Never was a nigger who didn't have an itchy foot, my dad used to say."
"Who set the trap that killed son Tidwell's boy? Was it your father, Bill? Was it Fred?" His eyes moved. His jaw never did.
"I don't know what you're talking about.
I hear him crying in my house. Do you know what it's like to hear a dead child crying in your house?
Some bastard trapped him like a weasel, and I hear him crying in my fucking house.
You're going to need a new caretaker, Bill said. I can't do for you no more. Don't want to. What I want is for you to get off my porch.
What's happening? Help me, for Christ's sake.
I'll help you with the toe of my shoe if you don't get going on your own.
I looked at him a moment longer, taking in the wet eyes and the set jaw, his divided nature written on his face.
I lost my wife, you old bastard, I said, a woman you claimed to love.
Now his jaw moved at last. He looked at me with surprise and injury.
That didn't happen here, he said. That didn't have anything to do with here. She might have been off the TI because, well, she might have had her reasons to be off the TI, but she just had a stroke. Would have happened anywhere. Anywhere.
I don't believe that. I don't think you do either. Something followed her to Derry, maybe because she was pregnant. Bill's eyes widened. I gave him a chance to say something, but he didn't take it. Or maybe just because she knew too much.
She had a stroke. Bill's voice wasn't quite even. I read the obituary myself. She had a damn stroke.
What did she find out? Talk to me, Bill. Please.
There was a long pause. Until it was over, I allowed myself the luxury of thinking I might actually be getting through to him. I've only got one more thing to say to you, Mike. Stand back. For the sake of your immortal soul, stand back and let things run their course. They will, whether you do or don't. This river has almost come to the sea. It won't be dammed by the likes of you. Stand back, Mike, for the love of Christ.
Do you care about your soul, Mr. Noonan? God's butterfly caught in a cocoon of flesh that will soon stink like mine?
Bill turned and walked to his door, the heels of his work boots clodding on the painted boards. Stay away from Maddie and Kai, I said, if you so much as go near that trailer. He turned back, and the hazy sunshine glinted on the tracks below his eyes. He took a bandana from his back pocket and wiped his cheeks.
I ain't stirring from this house. I wish to God I'd never come back from my vacation in the first place, but I did. Mostly on your account, Mike. Those two down on Wasp Hill have nothing to fear from me. No, not from me.
He went inside and closed the door. I stood there looking at it, feeling unreal. Surely I could not have had such a deadly conversation with Bill Dean, could I? Bill, who had reproached me for not letting folks down here share and perhaps ease my grief for Joe. Bill, who had welcomed me back so warmly. Then I heard a clack sound. He might not have locked his door while he was at home in his entire life, but he had locked it now. The clack was very clear in the breathless July air. It told me everything I had to know about my long friendship with Bill Dean. I turned and walked back to my car, my head down. Nor did I turn when I heard a window run up behind me.
"Don't you ever come back here, you town bastard!" Yvette Dean cried across the sweltering dooryard. "You've broken his heart. Don't you ever come back. Don't you ever. Don't you ever."
"Please," Mrs. M said, "don't ask me any more questions, Mike. I can't afford to get in Bill Dean's bad books any more than my ma could afford to get into Norman Auster's or Fred Dean's."
I shifted the phone to my other ear. "All I want to know is, in this part of the world, caretakers pretty well run the whole show. If they say to a summer fella that he should hire this carpenter or that electrician, why, that's who the summer fella hires. Or if the caretaker says this one should be fired because he ain't proven reliable, he is fired. Or she. Because what goes once for plumbers and landscapers and electricians has always gone twice for housekeepers. If you want to be recommended, and stay recommended, you have to keep on the sunny side of people like Fred and Bill Dean, or Normal and Kenny Auster. Don't you see?" She was almost pleading. "When Bill found out I told you about what Normal Auster did, ooh, he was so mad at me."
Kenny Auster's brother, the one Normal drowned under the pump, his name was Carrie?
"Yeah.
I've known a lot of folks name their kids alike, think it's cute. Why, I went to school with a brother and sister named Roland and Rolanda Terrio. I think Roland's in Manchester now, and Rolanda married that boy from...
Brenda, just answer one question. I'll never tell. Please?
I waited, my breath held, for the click that would come when she put her telephone back in its cradle. Instead, she spoke three words in a soft, almost regretful voice. What is it? Who was Carla Dean? I waited through another long pause, my hand playing with the ribbon that had come off Kai's turn-of-the-century straw hat.
You dasn't tell anyone I told you anything, she said at last.
I won't.
Carla was Bill's twin sister. She died 65 years ago during the time of the fires.
The fires Bill claimed had been set by Kai's grandfather, his going-away present to the TR.
I don't know just how it happened. Bill never talks about it.
If you tell him I told you, I'll never make another bed in the TR. He'll see to it.
Then, in a hopeless voice, she said, he may know anyway.
Based on my own experiences and surmises, I guess she might be right about that. But even if she was, she'd have a check from me every month for the rest of her working life. I had no intention of telling her that over the telephone, though. It would scald her Yankee soul. Instead, I thanked her, assured her again of my discretion, and hung up. I sat at the table for a moment, staring blankly at Bunter, then said, "Who's here?" No answer. "Come on," I said. "Don't be shy. Let's go 19 or 92 down. Barring that, let's talk." Still no answer. Not so much as a shiver of the bell around the stuffed moose's neck. I spied the scribble of notes I'd made while talking to Joe's brother and drew them toward me. I had put Kaya, Kyra, Keto, and Carla in a box. Now I scribbled out the bottom line of that box and added the name Carrie to the list.
I've known a lot of folks name their kids alike, Mrs. Emmett said. They think it's cute.
I didn't think it was cute. I thought it was creepy. It occurred to me that at least two of these sound-alikes had drowned. Carrie Oster under a pump, Kaya Noonan in her mother's dying body when she wasn't much bigger than a sunflower seed. And I had seen the ghost of a third drowned child in the lake. Keto? Was that one Keto? Or was Keto the one who had died of blood poisoning? They name their kids alike. They think it's cute.
How many sound-alike kids had there been to start with? How many were left? I thought the answer to the first question didn't matter, and I knew the answer to the second one already.
This river has almost come to the sea, Bill had said.
Carla, Carrie, Keto, Kaya, all gone. Only Kyra DeVore was left.
I got up so fast and hard that I knocked over my chair. The clatter in the silence made me cry out. I was leaving, and right now. No more telephone calls, no more playing Andy Drake, private detective, no more depositions or half-assed wooings of the lady fair. I should have followed my instincts and gotten the fuck out of Dodge that first night. Well, I'd go now, just get in the Chevy and haul ass for dare.
Bunter's bell jangled furiously. I turned and saw it bouncing around his neck as if batted to and fro by a hand I couldn't see.
The screen door giving on the deck began to fly open and clap shut like something hooked to a pulley. The book of tough stuff crossword puzzles on the sofa and the DSS program guide blew open, their pages riffling. There was a series of rattling thuds across the floor as if something enormous was crawling rapidly toward me, pounding its fists as it came. A draft, not cold but warm, like the rush of air produced by a subway train on a summer night, buffeted past me. In it, I heard a strange voice which seemed to be saying, "Bye-bye, bye-bye, bye-bye," as if wishing me a good trip home. Then, as it dawned on me that the voice was actually saying, "Kai-kai, kai-kai, kai-kai," something struck me and knocked me violently forward. It felt like a large, soft fist.
I buckled over the table, clawing at it to stay up, overturning the Lazy Susan with the salt and pepper shakers on it, the napkin holder, the little vase Mrs. M. had filled with daisies. The vase rolled off the table and shattered. The kitchen TV blared on, some politician talking about how inflation was on the march again. The CD player started up, drowning out the politician. It was the Rolling Stones doing a cover of Sarah Tidwell's I Regret You, Baby. Upstairs, one smoke alarm went off, then another, then a third. They were joined a moment later by the warble whoop of the Chevy's car alarm. The whole world was cacophony. Something hot and pillowy seized my wrist. My hand shot forward like a piston and slammed down on the steno pad. I watched as it pawed clumsily to a blank page, then seized the pencil which lay nearby. I gripped it like a dagger, and then something wrote with it, not guiding my hand, but raping it. The hand moved slowly at first, almost blindly, then picked up speed until it was flying, almost tearing through the sheet. Help her. Don't go. Help her. Don't go. Help her. Help. Don't. Baby, please don't go. Help her. Help her. Help her. I had almost reached the bottom of the page when the cold descended again. That outer cold that was like sleet in January, chilling my skin and crackling the snot in my nose and sending two shuddery puffs of white air from my mouth. My hand clenched and the pencil snapped in two. Behind me, Bunter's bell rang out one final furious convulsion before falling silent. Also from behind me came a peculiar double pop, like the sound of champagne corks being drawn. Then it was over. Whatever it had been, or however many they had been, it was finished. I was alone again. I turned off the CD player just as Mick and Keith moved on to a white boy version of Howling Wolf, then ran upstairs and pushed the reset buttons on the smoke detectors. I leaned out the window of the big guest bedroom while I was up there, aimed the fob of my key ring down at the Chevrolet, and pushed the button on it. The alarm quit. With the worst of the noise gone, I could hear the TV cackling away in the kitchen. I went down, killed it, then froze with my hand still on the off button, looking at Joe's annoying waggy cat clock. Its tail had finally stopped switching, and its big plastic eyes lay on the floor. They had popped right out of its head. I went down to the village cafe for supper, snagging the last Sunday telegram from the rack. Computer mogul DeVore dies in western Maine town where he grew up, the headline read, before sitting down at the counter. The accompanying photo was a studio shot of DeVore that looked about 30 years old. He was smiling. Most people do that quite naturally. On DeVore's face, it looked like a learned skill. I ordered the beans that were left over from Buddy Jellison's Saturday night beanhole supper. My father wasn't much for aphorisms. In my family, dispensing nuggets of wisdom was Mom's job. But as Daddy warmed up the Saturday night yellow eyes in the oven on Sunday afternoon, he would invariably say that beans and beef stew was better the second day. I guess it stuck. The only other piece of fatherly wisdom I can remember receiving was that you should always wash your hands after you took a shit in a bus station. While I was reading the story on DeVore, Audrey came over and told me that Royce Merrill had passed without recovering consciousness. The funeral would be Tuesday afternoon at Grace Baptist, she said. Most of the town would be there, many folks just to see Isla Meserve awarded the Boston Post cane. Did I think I'd get over? No, I said. Probably not. I thought it prudent not to add that I'd likely be attending a victory party at Maddie DeVore's while Royce's funeral was going on down the road. The usual late Sunday afternoon flow of customers came and went while I ate. People ordering burgers, people ordering beans, people ordering chicken salad sandwiches, people buying six-packs. Some were from the TR, some from away. I didn't notice many of them, and no one spoke to me. I have no idea who left the napkin on my newspaper, but when I put down the A section and turned to find the sports, there it was. I picked it up, meaning only to put it aside, and saw what was written on the back in big dark letters. Get off the TR. I never found out who left it there. I guess it could have been any of them.